Welcome back for episode 134. So how you doing, Joe?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Feeling safe and secure because I know that the wise men are meeting at this very minute to keep me safe from foreign evildoers.
Keeping you safe from yourself as well.
Yes, because it's the national security state. Now, we decided to talk about the monumental National Security Act of 1947. This piece of legislation mandated a major reorganization of the foreign policy and military establishments of the U.S. government. The act created many of the institutions that the presidents have found useful when formulating their foreign policy. It established a National Security Council, NSC. The NSC was created to assist in the coordination of the nation's security assets. The NSC includes the president, the vice president, the president's national security advisor, the secretary of state, secretary of defense, and other presidential appointees approved by the U.S. Senate. Beginning in 1953, the president's assistant for national security affairs, or national security advisor, directed this staff. Initially, a small NSC staff was hired to coordinate foreign policy materials from other agencies for the president. Under President Richard Nixon, the NSC staff, then headed by Henry Kissinger, was transformed from a coordinating body into an organization that actively engaged in negotiations with foreign leaders and implementing the president's decisions. The NSC meetings themselves, however, were infrequent and merely confirmed the decisions already agreed to by Nixon and Kissinger. Under President Reagan, Vice President George Bush oversaw the NSC, and this was interesting because suppose the NSC was there to sort of direct the CIA, and we know about George Bush's career, George H.W. Bush's career, was he was a CIA career man. So this was an example of the CIA itself directly, you could say at least that this was an example of the CIA itself getting direct control of the National Security Council. The National Security Act placed a tremendous amount of emphasis on the coordination of national security with the intelligence community and its many capabilities. Most notably, the legislation created the Central Intelligence Agency and established the position of Director of Central Intelligence, who was charged with managing the CIA as well as overseeing the entire intelligence community. The CIA was an amalgamation of World War II era offices like the Offices of Strategic Services and the small post-war intelligence organizations. The CIA served as the primary civilian intelligence gathering organization in the government. Later, the Defense Intelligence Agency became a main military intelligence body. Also, in the early 50s, the National Security Agency was established, which now is the largest intelligence agency itself, primarily focusing on signal intelligence. But that's another thing, the creation of the National Security Agency. People didn't know it existed until the 1970s, I believe. The 1947 law, the National Security Act, caused far-reaching changes in the military establishment. The War Department and Navy Department merged into a single Department of Defense under the Secretary of Defense, who also directed the newly created Department of the Air Force. However, each of the three branches maintained their own service secretaries. The act also created the Joint Chiefs of Staff to advise the president on military strategy and planning, thus formalizing a relationship between the White House and the military services that had been established during World War II. The context of the National Security Act, of course, is the course of the early Cold War period, or even pre-Cold War, really. This is also coincides roughly with the George Kennan's Mr. X Telegram, the Long Telegram, which was later published in Foreign Affairs, a publication, the flagship publication of the Council for Foreign Relations, in his article, The Sources of Soviet Conduct. And basically, it called for a policy of containment towards the Soviet Union and established the foundations for America's early Cold War foreign policy. This is February and also the summer, through February and the summer of 1946. So, again, this is that's the National Security Act. It reorganized, like I said, reorganized the nation's military establishment and set up the it was a consummation or formalizing of this relation that existed for decades, really. You couldn't have gotten the, you know, like the Banana Wars, the War of Spanish, the Spanish-American War, without this relationship already existing. Big business and big government using the military and sort of these nascent or prototypical intelligence agencies to do their business. I mean, we've talked about Smedley Butler, and he, you know, he what he said, he was a, you know, a collection agent and a muscle man for big business, Brown Brothers, Harriman, and Wall Street. So this relationship pre-existed, but this was sort of, again, a consummation of this untoward relationship between big business and the U.S. government. And of course, this so that's the sort of the official story of the National Security Act. We can talk, I think it's important to talk about some of the figures that are behind it, you know, by focusing on some of these personalities, we can get a better understanding of this relationship, because virtually everyone involved in the early days of the Cold War were Wall Street lawyers, bankers, tied to big business, law firms, you know, the Dulles brothers, Clark Clifford, Robert Lovett, you know, all these names tie back to Wall Street and the banks. So, Joe, what do you have to say about the National Security Act?
Well, I think it's unconstitutional. I think that, you know, as you look at the Constitution, there's no provision for the creating of secret agencies that are outside the preview of Congress. And when they are outside, then what can democracy do about nefarious activities? So the act created the NSC and the CIA. The NSA and the CIA, and then within a few years they created the final one, the third piece, the NSC. The NSA. Yeah, the NSC and the CIA were created in 1947, and then in 1950 you brought along the NSA. So you had the three different intelligence agencies. And I would say that really what had happened here with the act is that you simply were transitioning from kind of secret society control over the intelligence gathering aspect of our government to basically moving the secret societies right into bureaucracies so that they didn't have to worry any longer about being, you know, ferreted out, this relationship between like Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and Freemasonry and in the intelligence agencies could be done away with. I think that's actually what went on here. And if you look at the, you said we'd talk about the individuals. I mean, you just think about, you know, in 1947, you have the Freemason Truman as the president. In Europe, you got George Marshall, the big Mason. In the Pacific Theater, running stuff is MacArthur, the big Mason. And then, you know, in the middle of all that, you have all the Skull and Bone guys who are around the White House. And I mean, if you actually go through the individuals who are going to be taken over the different aspects of the alphabet soup agencies, they're all Freemasons. And of course, you've already got the FBI sitting there being run by J. Edgar Hoover, the Freemason. And so you mentioned Robert Lovett. I mean, he's Skull and Bones. You know, you have, of course, Avril Harriman, you know, was involved with this, Skull and Bones. You've got, well, of course, the Bush family, and then McGeorge Bundy. They're all Skull and Bones. So, I mean, it's really just a, as I see it, it's just a transfer of these secret societies' functions inside our government into a bureaucratic stage where they no longer basically have this relationship back to the secret society. They have moved the secret society right into government. And so, And in order to do that, they had to make sure that these agencies couldn't be penetrated by democracy. And so that's why they're set up to be basically impenetrable. I mean, you can no more audit the CIA than you could audit the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, right? Joe, according to Skull and Bones, Wim F. Buckley, this was necessary.
Because, of course.
Because for the duration of the conflict, we had to accept this.
Tim, I have to admit, I had a moment of cynicism when I was like studying this, because I was sitting there, like, reading the National Security Act of 1947. It's just this, you know, gobbledygook about, you know, we've got the, gosh darn, we've got so many things we have to protect, and the commies are everywhere, you know, and it's just a nightmare. We need to have, it has to be secret, but we need to, also we need a budget, you know, we have to be able to, you know, get that. And I'm reading this, and I go, well, okay, yeah, you guys did a great job. I'm glad you set it up. I mean, the most important secret we had was, of course, the nuclear bomb, which was stolen just lock, stock, and barrel right out from under your noses the very first month of your organization or first year. So, I mean, this is how preposterous the whole thing is, that the one thing they had to keep track of, they forgot. And it just, the terror weapon gets out to the evil Soviet Union. But this, of course, think about what it does. Tim, now they are all justified in their existence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, because look, the Soviets have the bomb, and gosh darn it, you know, those commies are going to be overblowing us up if we don't stop them. And so we need to have this secrecy.
Well, it's vindicated because just a few years later, North Korea invades South Korea in a prelude to world conquest.
Of course, they'd be over. They would have been in Hollywood within a few months if we didn't have the CIA. You know, so the whole thing is just, as I said, if you, you know, and I'll tell you, I'm going to just segue for a second. One thing, when I went through this, I was absolutely astounded at the degree that Skull and Bones was involved in all of these different alphabet soup agencies. I mean, there was like, really, if you exclude out Bohemian Grove, Freemasonry, and Skull and Bones from the management, there isn't any. They just literally had every single position under their control. And when I saw this, when I actually saw, gosh, good heavens, you know, they're just everywhere, I realized why Tim Russert, the news broadcaster, had been murdered. Remember, he had asked Kerry and Bush both, you know, if they could talk a little bit about Skull and Bones. And then he died mysteriously of a heart attack and at a young age. And I remember, because I had not, you know, at the time that this happened, I really wasn't certainly interested in any, you know, conspiracy theories. But I do remember how strange it was that when Russert was murdered, in my opinion, the news shows had all of these kind of video presentations about heart disease and cardiac arrest and heart failure. You know, they had these video movies about it to go along with the news story. And I thought that was very unusual. And of course, you know, in hindsight, you could see they were just trying to mind control to make it a little bit more believable. But anyway, I realized going through all of the alphabet soup administrative people from Stinson, you know, to Truman setting it up, we'll bore people with the long list. They can do, this is just transparent research, but the reason why they had to kill him is because it wasn't because of either one of the questions to Bush or to Kerry. It was because they didn't want this line of questioning to go any further, because if it ever does, then people will realize that democracy is completely a facade. It doesn't really exist. You're just picking the individuals from the different secret societies to put into the positions of power so they can, you know, enslave you. Because I just think that this is actually almost like as strong an evidence for like a regular sort of citizen. If you could actually show them that there's nothing but Bohemian Grove, Freemasonry, and Skull and Bone people in all these positions of power. And that just regardless of whatever you think about those organizations, they are secret societies. And you don't really know what goes on behind the secrecy. So therefore, your democracy is fake because you have no idea what you're getting when these people take over. So, you know, that was the... That's the main thing that I would point out to people is that the alphabet soup are just basically like a governmental levels of the secret society. They're like a degree of Freemasonry, basically. And there's just you know, if you look at the individuals who are going in to run them, obviously they're already oath taking and insider, you know, kind of allegiance that's already in effect. And so the whole thing is a facade. And I was thinking that, you know, it would be nice instead of calling them by their propaganda name, like Central Intelligence Agency, you know, they actually had a moniker that was reflective of their behavior. I mean, like the secret CIA could be like, you know, Department of Mind Control and Human Experimentation for Enslavement. You know, FBI could be, you know, like investigation into, you know, illicit sexual activities for the purpose of blackmail. You know, in other words, that would be, you know, how I would try to get people to start to think about these things as when the secrecy that they stand behind enables them to do tremendous evil. I mean, already, you know, you have this warrantless search business that was exposed, that the NSA was engaged in, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously unconstitutional. I mean, how in the world can, search and seizure, unreasonable search and seizure not be violated when they don't have to get any kind of warrants any longer? They can just pick and choose who they decide to snoop on. Well, democracy is now, you know, it's being exposed as for what it is. It's just fake. And the secret societies have created these agencies as levels of impenetrable bureaucracy behind which we just cannot see anything. We know that we need greater and more sophisticated weaponry and snooping devices every single day because, you know, Soleimani is going to be invading, the commies will be bombed. You know, there's always the terror excuse. But really what is going on behind the secrecy is just the development of the technologic slave state.
Well, particularly now with surveillance capitalism, you don't even have to rely on, explicit or government agencies anymore. Now it's because now you spy on yourself with Google and Facebook and even every day how you shop and how you communicate on your cell phone. And all this data is being stored and being sold off to, you know, I guess advertising or corporations for marketing, but also to, you know, interested government agencies or even, you know, private intelligence groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center or the ADL or, you know, whatever, you know, even Blackwater or Z or whatever it's called now. Private, you know, corporations that are involved in it now. And they don't even have to worry about the Fourth Amendment because when you're watching television, the television is watching you back, which yeah. People don't gleefully sign up for, or they have the convenience of Alexa telling them how what the weather is, or to turn down, you know, the lights in the den. But, you know, this necessitates Alexa and Amazon listening to you 24/7. And all that information is indeed being gathered up and sold off to interested parties. That's the business model for Facebook, which was set up by InQtel, which was the venture capital firm of the NSA and CIA, which was created by the National Security Act. So we don't even have that government distinction anymore.
No, that's a good point. And that kind of underlines what I was trying to say is that you can see the purpose of it. When you look at Facebook, right, what they've done is now they have finally got the snooping technology in a form where it is just completely impenetrable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if this was all done during the period when the alphabet soup agencies were basically helping all of this technology get developed. You know, you think about like MKUltra, DARPA, things like this, which then end up being used as algorithms at Facebook and technology with Google. So, you know, this is how the slave state is being implemented and designed. You know, it's Goethe's statement is that the most helplessly enslaved person is the one who doesn't understand that is his condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so here is why, you know, they developed these alphabet soup agencies to hide behind and to get people used to not being able to question. I mean, none of the relationships between the technology companies that look at us and the government should ever have been permitted to exist without democracy being able to scrutinize every single bit and instruction code. Not a single one of them should ever have been permitted. They are all absolutely unconstitutional, absolutely unconstitutional. But now that they're in place, their power is, you know, is going to be something to behold, because look at just as they were able to try to stop our ship. Look at the way that the censorship operated. You know, they just have some big data that just looks at the title of the show, let alone any of the content, and they just go, well, this is not the wrong right words for the public to listen to. Out it goes, mm-hmm. right? Suddenly it's restricted. They restrict it in different ways. Well, okay, so this is what we're facing, and you can also see it in like the Google search algorithms, which I was been looking at this week. They're getting so sophisticated. You know, they've really got the software working to the oligarch's enslavement procedure accurately now, because if you Google in something that used to bring up the conspiracy theory ideas, which were by far and away the most popular, mm-hmm. they not only you have to go through like 20 pages to get them, but they have counter arguments that are visible, you know, in the headlines that they're trying to get at your mind with, mm-hmm. so get these bad thoughts out of you, you know.
Now,
so,
yeah, and of course, if you Google a standard narrative of some of these events, they don't provide counter arguments to those.
No, of course not. You know. No, so there it is. Yeah. It's like it's one dimensional. You know, it's the idea that we will be thought puppets. You know, where they can manipulate us through our desire to participate in the, you know, in the internet world. And that's why, you know, it's so disheartening and frightening to see the addiction to the iPhone that has been so successful. I mean, it's just amazing how they've been able to change human behavior so quickly. You know, you go to a public event, you know, even like a restaurant, I mean, 60-70% of the people at the tables have the iPhone out. And when the phone goes off with an internet communication of some kind, it's completely normal manners to just disregard whatever you were doing with the human being and just turn into the iPhone and go into that reality. It becomes like it is the dominant stream of communication to your consciousness. The humans that you're with are secondary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This creates a culture of narcissism, atomization, and also solipsism, meaning, you know, they just, and this is part of the marketing, because they'll direct information, they'll, through their algorithms, they'll determine what you're interested in and then tailor the information that goes to you, whether it's advertising or books or news, towards your interests. And so there's no cross-pollination of ideas or anything, and everything becomes narrowed into your specific immediate interest.
That's what they've done. And they become so perfect in fine-tuning it. See, this mm-hmm. is the thing, is like, it's that you don't know what's going on. You can try to find like a, you know, you say like 911, you're not believing, you know, in the accidental symmetrical collapse or something like this. And they will very subtly move you to a kind of a midway point of, you know, like they'll take it to Alex Jones or someone who has, you know, some kind of mildly contradictory. See, they don't, in other words, what I'm saying is they don't move you all the way into an opposition point. Mm-hmm. They have studied you. And you get like, you know, flavor XQ, which is exactly what they think they can use to move your mind in a better direction. That's what's happening. It's these algorithms are very sophisticated. So they're very sophisticated psychological tools. And getting back to the, you know, the CIA, the creation of the alphabet soup, I mean, what you're looking at with Google now is just the science of MK Ultra, you know, in an applied form, right? I mean, and when you look at how MK Ultra, this huge project that ran for a decade, studying every imaginable way of getting at the human mind, and breaking every law, every constitutional principle, just out the window, right? They're killing people, giving them LSD without their, you know, awareness. You know, they're using low frequency energy on human brains. I mean, it's just an absolute genocidal approach to, you know, they could care less about humanity. Well, okay, so this is what the secrecy was for. And now when you get to Google, they have got a lot figured out as that you know, comes from the MKUltra and from beyond that, because this is what we have been able to basically uncover. But this is no doubt just the tip of the iceberg. They have to be far more sophisticated in their research than this kind of that kind of, I think, ham-handed stuff.
Well, you know, when the National Security Act created something like CIA, and of course at the time the letter of the law said the CIA was there to coordinate. I mean, it's the director of Central Intelligence. He isn't director of the Central Intelligence Agency. That's the title. And he, the director there, he was supposedly there to coordinate, you know, collect, coordinate, and all the intelligence, and deliver to the president in some sort of coherent, you know, digestible form. That was the idea. Because, you know, the myth is the disaster at Pearl Harbor was created because of a lack of coordination and communication between the disparate intelligence agencies and the military weren't communicating. And so that's set up for the surprise attack. Well, that's pretty much a myth. And so that was just a pretext, because, you know, the attacks were known, they were provoked and known, and they were pretty much followed all the way, Yamamoto was pretty much followed all the way, you know, till the moment his planes, you know, struck Pearl Harbor. So that's not a true justification anyway. But what happened was, originally the CIA was given no authority to carry out covert operations. And this is where personality is very important. When Dulles became the director in 1953, he had a profound effect on the CIA's mission. One thing is, he was very gung-ho in getting involved in covert operations. And the way he did that, of course, Dulles himself, you got to look at Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles. These guys, you know, were go there. I think Dulles himself, Alan Dulles, was scrolling key, went to Princeton. They were Princeton boys, I think. But anyway, these guys pretty much were the twin pillars of American foreign policy in the immediate Cold War era, post-war era. And they represented big business. That was their law firm, you know, Sullivan and Cromwell. And they were the nephew of Woodrow Wilson's Lansing, the Secretary of State, who replaced William Jennings Bryan because he wasn't completely on board with the Wilson administration's war agenda. So their lineage, their background, family, they were well connected, and they were at Versailles and all that. And of course, Alan Dulles was in Switzerland during the war, working out deals with the SS and all this post-war era with paperclip and all that. So when he became director, he was able to, just through manipulating the situation, establish for the CIA a covert operation. And one of the problem, this is the biggest problem when you create a secret intelligence agency. Again, it roped in OSS and Office of Planning or something, Coordination, Office of Policy Coordination, with this was Frank Wisner's operation. These were the fun and games branches of the intelligence agency carrying out covert operations. Stuff they did during the war, they had all these assets left over from the war, and they were going to be applied to the Cold War era. So they were able to develop assets throughout the U.S. government, and also once you do that, what Dulles would do is he would place CIA assets or agents in various government bureaucracies, and within a few years, these guys would be CIA, but they'd rise to that bureaucracy. So pretty soon, the entire federal government would be infiltrated by CIA agents. And just the ability to carry out covert operations, those abilities increased throughout the 1950s, you could subvert any oversight or meaningful oversight in a part of the civilian branch, the overt side of the government. So the entire government gradually became subverted by the secret agencies, which is inevitable if you create secret agencies outside oversight. And oversight becomes meaningless because you have whether it's the FBI or even the private intelligence groups like the ADL carrying out surveillance and blackmailing congressmen and senators to blunt any meaningful oversight, which is what they did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and leading up to the Church Committee hearings to blunt that investigation. So there's effectively no control of these agencies, outside the law. And the law itself isn't really followed once attitudes change, because then the myth of the CIA, where it's an intelligence covert operation, that's what everyone thinks the CIA is now, although the law never gave it that power. And so that's how it's taken over. Good example, figures like that, people think about Lansdale, Ed Lansdale, who was an Air Force general, but was always CIA. So again, or even if they put people in the FAA or Department of Agriculture, and this is how covert operations are facilitated, because that way you can, FAA, you can prevent any interdiction of drugs, same with the Department of Agriculture, or you can also work with the secretive central bank to fund operations. And that's what it is rumored that the New York Fed funded billions of dollars in covert operations throughout the decades without any oversight, which is something that's easy to do if you control the printing press. When your operations are secret. So that effectively the secret government has taken over all the name of national security, which gets to another point, is this is national security era. This is a new term that developed in the post-war era, national security. Before it was called, national defense or defense and these things. What exactly is national security? Well, think about some of the early successful CIA operations, whether it's overthrowing the Mossadegh regime in Iran or the Arbenz regime in Guatemala. They're all done in the interest and the behest of corporations like United Fruit or the Seven Sisters Oil Companies. So it gives you an indication of who the CIA was really representing in these coups that were brought out in the 50s. This is all done for the benefit of corporations, the boards that these are corporations that Alan Dulles actually sat on the board of, and or his brother, and same with Richard Helms. He was on the board of AT&T when they took out helped take out Allende in Chile in 73. And this gives us an idea of what the agency is really doing. They're an agency, and they're an agency acting on whose interest are they acting? Well, it's called national security, national interest, but it's got nothing to do with you and me and the average American. It's, if anything, it's working against their interest, because it's getting America constantly embroiled in foreign wars, getting soldiers killed, putting the country deeper and deeper in the debt, spilling the nation's blood and treasure, all in the name of some corporate interests. They're owned by a handful of families in the final analysis.
The veil of secrecy has just constantly permitted evil to operate. And it also is a kind of mind control thing. When you go through all of those events, I mean, like United Fruit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this should have been something that democracy had, a stronger opinion about, right? It was such an evil thing. It was so obvious. But no, it's a skull and bones pretty much operation, and never really gets that much attention somehow. It just sort of disappears. There's a few whistleblowers, and like the other things you were talking about, it just sort of disappears into history, right?
Yeah, if you're a troublemaker like James Forrestal, you get tossed out a window.
Right.
I mean, it's like, so again, this ain't, it's set up, and it may not be monolithic at the beginning. And the fact that we call it the intelligence community doesn't mean it's monolithic. Obviously, they're competing bureaucratic interests at any given time, even factions within the ruling elite. And some have, some are dominant in a certain era and some aren't. Like the WASP era kind of was eclipsed in the 70s. And I think now where the Jewish faction is predominant now. It's hard to really get who's on top and what the, who's really at the top of the pyramid, but we get this. But you know, the fact that James Forrestal had to be defenestrated, and he was out of, by the way, he was out of power. He was the first Secretary of Defense, by the way, under the reorganization. And he started giving, started voicing opposition to what was going on vis-a-vis Israel and the establishment, you know, of Israel and Palestine, and also a lot of other Cold War antics. He's the one, I think, that met with McCarthy.
Yeah,
and that right. famous statement said if it was a mistake, they would make a mistake in our favor every once in a while. You know, this does, isn't the case. And it was McCarthy, of course, also died relatively young. You know, food for thought.
Well, the thing is, it's you know, you have what I refer to as kind of the DNA, right, that pops up. It doesn't matter which secret society you're a member of. If you're inside the guild, you're going to have both Zionism and birth control and population reductions as of Gentiles as like basically your platform. When someone like Forrestal, you know, questions this, you become a target. When Tim Russert is asking to have an explanation as to what it means to democracy to have like both presidential candidates be members of a secret society, you know, he's not representing the correct DNA. You see, it's really not that hard to kind of make sense of the centrifugal energy that holds all of this together, because you can kind of see the basic principles that repeat themselves over and over again. You know, you don't really know, you know, there's always a question of ethnicity. I mean, you know, like E. Michael Jones kind of triangulates, you know, between the WASP and Jewish interests and Catholic interests. Mm-hmm. And I think he's onto something with this approach, but I would just say, you know, there is this issue of like crypto Jews, and you really would need to do, you know, just some DNA testing to make sure that you know, you were looking at basically the organization in the right way. I have been advocating that for some time. I, you know, don't know exactly what the results will be, but have my opinions. I think we need to get the data, and that'll help us understand, you know, what the attack is really, you know, what is the purpose of the thing. I wanted to mention like the secrecy. You know, the secrecy is also very useful for mind control. You know, I was thinking of like the, you know, Federal Reserve and the behavior in the last couple of months, where it has this bizarre kind of money that's being created for this repo problem. I won't go into this because I'm sure it would just put, you know, the listeners to sleep. But it's this really arcane financial problem, and the Fed just makes, you know, if it needs $50 billion, it just pops up. And it just it's unlimited. I mean, you know, it's $250 billion that has popped up, but no one really knows where the money goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, does it disappear? I mean, do they get it back? It's just this completely incomprehensible situation. And my point is that I believe the incomprehensibleness is deliberate, that this will be more and more the nature of our world, is that behind the secrecy, or as we understand what's going on, there will literally be simply an incomprehensible kind of dizzying array of disparate, unrelated, and illogical events that are being given to us as reality. And I'll give you not just the financialization. I think they're making it just completely incomprehensible you know, kind of impossible to understand world. Look at Syria. And we look at the Middle East in general, the whole situation with Iran.
Yeah, it's completely incoherent.
It's just completely incoherent. And when you listen to people,
it's wizardry.
You know, that's right. It's like wizardry. And I think that this is kind of like, it's really where I think, you know, they're going more and more in this direction, because when it's completely incoherent.
And the magician has the pretty assistant to distract everybody. Because when there's a pretty assistant, both the men and the women are looking at her for different reasons. But distract everybody.
Yeah, it's just these. And I think that, okay, so then you look at like, you know, Trump's, you know, impeachment. I think that what they're trying to do is to just create this just impossible to understand Klump. These are false theatrical events that they're presenting as history. I think this is clear. But they're presented in such a way that, like Syria, you can't even diagram the thing. It's just a madhouse. And what I think their point is they want to bifurcate. They want to have people who think about reality and people who don't. and we would be in the group that just doesn't even think about it. We just, you go through your existence and have some technical ability. You're basically a slave to the system, and that's it. And then as far as understanding things like, where does the money come from? Why am I always broke? What's the foreign policy in the Middle East made of? These things are impossible to understand. It's just a waste of time to try to even go into them, because you're going to hit, one, the incomprehensible wizardry of the different, groups that are fighting.
Well, who conducts or forms foreign policy? State Department, theoretically, the president, some input from the Congress, elected representatives, but it's really formulated by, secret societies or private organizations like the Council for Foreign Relations. If you look at even the people in public life, like whether it's Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld, or what's her name? The Bush administration, one that worked for Chevron, the lady, Secretary of State. The black lady.
I know. Condoleezza Rice.
Rice. They all, work for Chevron. Cheney's a member of the Council for Foreign Relations. Alan Greenspan, member of the Trilateral Commission. Donald Rumsfeld, military industrial complex guy, working for pharmaceutical defense agencies, a congressman. He's a Secretary of State or Defense and State. And so they're all connected. And of course, everyone knows that within the military-industrial complex and foreign policy establishment, it's highly incestuous. There's a revolving door. People know this, but if you apply some sort of conspiratorial analysis, you're dismissed by the mainstream as a crackpot. When that's obviously the relationship.
Of course it is. And that, I'm sorry. Yeah, but that's why we have the wall of incomprehensibility is the same thing as the alphabet soup.
Clark Clifford, the guy who wrote the National Security Act, or at least wrote most of it, banker, Wall Street lawyer. Dean Acheson, Wall Street lawyer. Harriman.
Prescott Bush. The CIA I think this is because in the original, the first iteration, like the OSS, the Mellon family had so much control of the intelligence agencies, and then that just
it was a private. That's happened after World War II. The Council for Foreign Relations are the ones that were going into the war in the late 30s. Yeah. These were the so-called experts. So after the war, they're the ones that staffed and advised the creation of the ballooning State Department and the intelligence agencies and the military establishment.
That's all by design. And then look at Britain. It's the exact same pattern. You have the banking families just in there, just thick as thieves in the intelligence agencies.
Yeah, wasn't it OSS? It was OSS. It was obviously Office of Strategic Services. But some people say it was called OSO Social because of the...
It was just the social club of the elite.
And from what I understand, is the military intelligence agencies looked upon the OSS with contempt because they thought these were the reckless boys who didn't know what they were doing.
They didn't understand. Thing is that this we should get back to that point, is that the reason that they made this transition in order to create this veil so that they could insert skull and bones and Freemasonry into a more, didn't have to really worry about being scrutinized, is that the original intelligence agencies had a direct relationship to the military, which is something that democracy could look at.
Yes.
You see? Yeah. You see, this is why they made this transition, is that when you had these things under the auspice of the military, they couldn't be sure that some congressperson would go, wait a second. Wait a second. I want to see the budget. I want to see how this form. In other words, there was the chance that democracy would interact with the intelligence agencies, right? It was always a threat. And so that's why they made this transition, because as soon as they created this thing, they started moving away from Congress having any capacity at all. And, Tim, all you have to do to verify this is just look at what is going on today with these agencies and our foreign policy and what our Congress is aware of. Mm-hmm. I mean, Congress doesn't even know any of these things. They have no idea what's going on in behind, you know, these things. They're actually, the way that the secrecy is operated now, it's so severe. I mean, could you imagine like a congressperson showing up at the CIA and saying, I want to come in here. I need to like look through the records because I want to make sure that my constituency's constitutional rights aren't being violated. You know?
Well, I mean, you can't reveal sources and methods. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Well, therefore, you know, it's like the Federal Reserve. So we can't audit the CIA. We can't audit the FBI. We can't audit the
Joe, their successes are secret, and their failures are, you know, there for all to see. So you get a skewed picture of things.
I'm so sorry about this. I still want to go back. It's like, gee, we created these secret agencies, and all they have to do is watch one thing, the nuclear bomb, and that thing gets to Russia in like 2 months or something.
Yeah, it's like fast-tracked.
It's ludicrous, you know. So
well, you know the term Cold War? You know who coined it?
Uh-uh.
Well, 1947, the same year as the National Security Act, Bernard Baruch.
Oh, good old Bernard. Yeah.
Cold War, April 16th, 1947. On this day, 1947, Bernard Baruch, the multimillionaire financier and advisor to presidents from Woodrow Wilson to Harry S. Truman, coined the term Cold War to describe the increasingly chilly relations between World War II allies, the United States, and the Soviet Union. Baruch used the phrase in a speech to the South Carolina House of Representatives, where his portrait was being unveiled. Let us not be deceived, Brooke said. We are today in the midst of a Cold War. Our enemies are to be found abroad and at home. Let us never forget this. Our unrest is the heart of their success. September 1947, Walter Lippmann, Brooke's friend, and one of the day's most widely read journalists, used Cold War in his New York Herald Tribune column. Of course, Bernard Baruch, after making a fortune on Wall Street, he used his winter... He'd wintered in Hopkow Barony, his 17,500-acre estate in South Carolina coastline. So here you have a Wall Street multimillionaire coining the term Cold War, and of course you have Winston Churchill doing his duty, you know, showing up in Missouri and making the Iron Curtain speech.
Oh, that's right.
Fulton, Missouri.
Yeah, well, you know, just to like the vocabulary of the cesspool, one thing that when I was looking at this week that kind of amused me was, do you know where the CIA designation of spook comes from? You know how their agents are referred to as spooks?
Oh, yeah. I thought maybe they glow. What was that?
It comes from, no, it's what the members of Skull and Bones called one another.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Spooks. And then the other thing that really amused me was looking at Skull and Bones, and it's just, I mean, Tim, it is like a absolute cesspool inside these agencies, you know, that the CIA actually had the Bonesman Club, so where they could meet, you know, the Skull and Bones people, a little secret. While they're making the transition of the CIA away from, you know, OSS, because I'm sure at first there were some people involved with it that were regular people. They had to do that. But then over time, they get rid of it. So they had this little area where it was the Bonesmen. But the Skull and Bones had, like, it was a legal corporation, which was owned by the Russell Trust. Mm-hmm. And it actually had a designation of an address because being like it was under the laws of corporations, so it had to have an address. You probably would never guess it was Brown Brothers Harriman. So I mean, it is just a total cesspool. I mean, it is just democracy is not penetrating into this whatsoever. And you know, it's sort of a treasure that we have the period between like 1850 and 1950 with a lot of documentation. A lot of the names of the individuals who were running things are available. We can do research and, you know, make this all known to people, because I think it's like as strong of evidence of the secret society's existence and, you know, what they are about as like 9-1-1 was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just so overwhelming that these tiny organizations, I mean, just to give you an idea, Skull and Bones may have, like, at any one time living like 500 people, of which maybe 300 would be even possibly willing to or able physically to stop, you know, stealing money on Wall Street and then come down to Washington and run the country, you know. So it's just new, you know, mathematically impossible that these tiny organizations could infest all of this authority, and particularly in areas where you have secrecy, without there being, you know, the need to explain it with some clear-cut conspiratorial, you know, like, principle that is operating all this stuff. And I think that that, again, I think it's that clear that it occurred to me that's why Russert got murdered, is because it wasn't because of what, you know, they could always blow off one, you know, hey, we just an accident. We're both in this. It's a eating society. You know, we meet for dinner. You know, why are you even bothering this? That isn't why he was. They got rid of him. They just didn't want this to spread out. They didn't want. Okay, well then, how come all of these people? You see, that's what I think is really powerful, is that you can go through such a collection of people. And there are people on the internet who've actually done this. They've gone and they've looked, and, you know, there, you can do the research. Google will give you a hard time, but people can do this. You can actually see that, you know, you can start connecting, you know, the Delanoers, Roosevelts, the Rockefeller, the Russell Trusts, you know, the Skull and Bones people, the Bush family, Stinton. I mean, they're all related into these secret societies, and they are creating what then is all hidden now in back of these alphabet soup, the NFA, the NSA, the NSC, the CIA, and the FBI.
Yeah, like you said, it formalized this relationship, and they created the bureaucracies. Yeah. In the past, they had to operate, you know, through their secret societies, and now they could just do overtly under the guise of national security, because they had arranged the international scene, or through their wars, the First World War, the Second World War, which gave rise to the Cold War, and this became the pretext for the national security state, and these bureaucracies that William F. Buckley wrote about, he said that we would have to live with, despite our misgivings, for the duration of the conflict. And of course, it's a forever war, because there's ever enemies, so that's, it's forever. And at the same, and it's around 1950, that's an interesting time, because this is, of course, you have, this is when the, you know, national security state is sort of, it's fledgling, it's spreading its wings, so to speak. You have the crisis in Korea, which Dean Acheson said saved us. Korea saved us, because it created the pretext for the national security state, and it did away all opposition. Even whatever opposition there was on Capitol Hill, this melted away under the fear of communism, because usually those people who are, those congressmen who had misgivings about the inherent, you know, bureaucratic size of the national security state as a threat to civil liberties and constitutional order, these very same people would be very critical of communism. So they were cornered. That's how you manipulate the dialectic, to get even people who oppose you to support you in the final analysis. That's what's so important about creating this international scene like this. But you did have pushback. I mean, you had, like I mentioned, James Forrestal. Of course, he met his demise, supposedly committing suicide, jumping out of a window. You had even McCarthy, although McCarthy was I think handled in the final analysis, you know, by first by Hoover, you know, and then by Roy Cohn, of all people. But he was onto something. He didn't quite understand what he was investigating, and what he was onto, perhaps, was what the Reese Committee was discovering with the private foundations and their use of subverting American government, constitutional government. And they started to investigate this. Of course, as soon as they started to find out what was going on, they were shut down.
Yeah. I mean, McCarthy was right on the cusp, in my opinion, of, like, actually finding out. And he could have done it just by the method we went through, you know, we've gone through in this little show.
He was identifying communists, but that was just...
He was trying to identify communists, but he was seeing all of the links between them and into the State Department.
Well, it's interesting that he was having conversations with Forrestal before Forrestal died.
Yeah, yeah. If McCarthy hadn't been shut down and managed, he would have gone forward and realized that it isn't the communism that are manipulating, you know, the State Department spooks. They're just one big clump.
Yeah.
He would have gone to that point. You know, it's we needed to combine McCarthy with Lyndon LaRouche, because between the two of them, they actually had, I think, the right understanding, you know, of like, this is an organized group. And the economic aspect, or however you want to characterize, you know, Marxism, is not really what's important. It is a group that wants political power for the purpose of world domination and genocide. Mm-hmm. I think that was actually what comes across. That was like kind of the message that the critics gave to Marxism, but they didn't merge that with the understanding that the Marxists in our government are just like the capitalist traitors in Marxism. It's all just one big clump of secret society, and you have these actors, people coming forward representing different ideas, different workers' paradise theories, and of course they're always pointing at the terrorist, right? You know, we've got to have the secret service, the secret society bureaucracies that the Soviet Union had, the KVD, you know,
NKVD, KGB.
We need the CIA because of this and that. So they have these excuses, and the public over time just gets exhausted and is willing to not try to defend the constitutional right, which is basically the, wait a second, you can't snoop on citizens. You know, you cannot snoop on citizens. And cannot do human experimentation for the purpose of understanding our minds for mind control.
Well, I mean, what's telling or what's interesting about this is you talked about can't snoop on citizens, but the whole system relied on everyone blackmailing each other. And of course, you start out with Hoover and the FBI.
Yeah.
And he started working with the ADL, and the ADL apparently had him blackmailed, and the mob had him blackmailed. So he started doing the bidding for the ADL and Jewish interest in the 30s and 40s. And then perhaps this is also used during the Cold War, because I think in the early stages of the Cold War, like I said, there's a lot of resistance to it, particularly by the Republicans. People forget that the Cold War at first was a Democratic Truman agenda. But I think it was Arthur Vandenberg who told Harry Truman, when Harry Truman talked about the Truman Doctrine and the trouble in Greece and the necessity for containment, and he advised the president to scare the hell out of the American people. I think it was Vandenberg himself was compromised with a girlfriend. And, of course, I mentioned the Reese Committee hearings. A central figure in shutting down that investigation was Wayne Hayes, the congressman from Ohio, I think.
Yeah,
and he's the one that helped shut down that the Reese Committee hearings in the investigation into the foundations. Of course, we found out 25 years later, you know, he was womanized, having an affair, when that scandal with Elizabeth Ray, when he hired this buxom blonde who couldn't type. I think that was a famous thing.
Sure.
So they're all sexually compromised. Everyone's kind of blackmailed in these things. Because that's relevant today, because the story's about, you know, what's going on. Perhaps that's what's behind Pizzagate. And of course the Jeffrey Epstein story, which we were instructed that we really couldn't find out what really was going on there, as the U.S. Attorney Acosta said he belonged to intelligence.
Well, they lost the videotape.
Yes.
And what a shock. And they, you know, it's just like the NSA. I mean, where were they? They should be like on top. They have every kind of imaginable snooping techniques. They have cameras of people, you know, videoing every little aspect. We can't keep this guy under surveillance, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's preposterous.
Well, overall, the National Security Act, it creates all these alphabet soup agencies, rules, and it systematized national security, coordinates everything to meet the threat abroad, this communist threat, and all that. So you have this aura or appearance of officialdom, of professionalism and expertise, but it doesn't function properly. And it doesn't function at all the way the law says it's supposed to function. Personalities take over, secret agendas take over. So all the laws, all the regulations you have are completely useless.
Yeah, I think the model for, you know, what happens in 47 is the P2 Lodge scandal in Italy.
Yeah, a parallel government, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very parallel. I mean, you have all of these people in secret societies that are in different aspects of government, and then you can see nefarious and basically a murderous activity against the citizens that's being discussed and authorized, and false dialectics for the purpose of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, I just think that if I was teaching a course in American civics, I would start out with the P2 Lodge.
Well, here's a good example of a conflict. And I don't want to give him too much credit, but I think there's some validity to the fact that with the presidency of John F. Kennedy, that perhaps he thought that his job was to control these agencies as president.
Oops. Yeah.
And it turns out that when he took on the CIA and he took on the Israeli interest, he got his head blown off. And it's interesting that it was during his presidency that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff proposed to him, the false flag Operation Northwoods for Cuba, which involved false flags, drones being shot out of the air, reports of planes being shot and deaths of American citizens to justify an invasion of Cuba. We've talked about Cuba, Castro, and these things, what's going on there. The suspect role of Fidel Castro. But this whole situation is where you're creating a theater to manipulate the opinion and the psychology of the American people to create this world system. And you also have, what you mentioned, P2 and Gladio in Europe, a false flag operation, facilitated by the agencies that are created by the National Security Act.
Right. And in P2, you could see they had all of the intelligence agencies wired. They had the police. They had all of the branches of the military, their intelligence. They're different. There was more than one. I think there was three. And they had the heads of all of them. I mean, Italy, I think, is kind of a microcosm of what was going on in the U.S. But this is the principle. This is why, these things are set up and why the secrecy.
Well, this goes way back. I remember. I think it was called, Operation Shamrock? This is during the analog era, but they pretty much all Western Union telegrams were being sucked up by the NSA illegally in the 60s and 70s. I think it was called Operation Shamrock. I might have that wrong. I get these code names mixed up. But all that was illegal, blatantly illegal, and no one was ever prosecuted. There are laws against this, and there's specific penalties, certain years in crime per offense and all that. We learned about that even with the illegal wiretapping under the George W. Bush administration. But no one has ever prosecuted for these violations. In fact, heck, the FBI building is still named after J. Edgar Hoover, despite what we know about his criminal activity.
Yeah,
there's never any penalty for this stuff.
But see, this data is really a treasure, because as we move toward the technologic slave state, they're going to get better and better. The Google algorithms, mm-hmm. right, are going to be in our mind for everything. But here, with like the P2 scandal, with like the infiltration of all of American intelligence agencies following the National Security Act creation of them, we have really good evidence. Our memories should be kept intact, and in fact we should focus on this aspect of our history and not so much worry about Syria and the financialization of the repo crisis, because there's too much control over the data, and you're not even going to be following a path, I think, that leads to any kind of clarity. In our history, there's clarity, because they didn't have the sophistication to be able to cover all this stuff up, and so thank heavens we have the actual records of the individuals, and then we can just cross correlate everything, and we can use some glimpses into reality, like the P2 Lodge scandal, where the documents became public knowledge, they were found. And the MKUltra documents, we can use these things as basically stepping stones so that we can understand, who is in back of and what is the purpose of the technological slave state that they're creating.
Yeah. And for those who think the suspicion that Tim Russert was murdered, officially he died of cardiac arrest. It was during the church committee hearings that I think it was Frank Church and Barry Goldwater. You can watch this on YouTube. And you have a secretary for the CIA, like a middle-aged lady. Looks like someone you might see at a bank, or might looks like a school principal or something, talking kind of prosaically about this heart attack gun. you know. Yeah. You know, and they the committee members are kind of holding the, looking at it, you know, this is interesting. And what does this do? And you know, and it, well, it injects a, you know, pierces the skin of the target and then brings on a heart attack and appear makes an assassination appear like someone dies of natural causes. And this is in the arsenal of the CIA. You know.
Yeah. And so the juxtaposition, you know, of him asking the question and the you know, the cardiac arrest certainly raises the question. I think Russert was like the last, you know, real journalist we had. I mean, what we've got now, I mean, literally it's tip to stern spooks.
Yeah. You know, well, that's just Operation Mockingbird. And that's 1950. Yeah.
You know, I tell you, it was funny, like I was in a public room and the TV was on. I mean, I don't watch this stuff, trust me, but Wolf Blitzer was on, and it was I think it was the night that Iran had launched the missiles back, you know, launched some ballistic missiles, blew up some, you know, some stuff in the desert. And Blitzer was talking, and I couldn't hear what he was saying, but I could hear his tone. And I realized, you know, this guy has been hysterical for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just has this hysteria button he can turn on, and it just goes nonstop, and it's all mind control, because the hysteria that you're seeing when he are listening or experiencing is supposed to make you terrorized.
Yeah, didn't he also used to work for AIPAC?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. As a matter of fact, and so you can see he's like a real, you know, objective kind of historian person to be like giving this information to the public, just in the same way that if you want to document things, you know, that are just absolutely critical for understanding of history, like, well, gee, like the camps during the Holocaust, you want to bring in your very best historical videographer. I mean, someone like Billy Wilder, so that, you know, you don't have any chance that, you know, drama and theater will enter into it. Right. This is what you get. You get your Billy Wilder. Or if you're like talking about the Suleiman, you know, like blow up stuff. You get, you know, a Wolf Blitzer. Let's let Wolf Blitzer have at it, you know, or Sean Hannity. These people are all trained. They're all actors. They couldn't be more fake. Once you kind of get in a little bit to, like, how the mind control works, you look at these guys, and, I mean, oh, my God, they are just so artificial. They literally are, you know, they're like Disney puppets or something.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Drew, think we covered it?
Oh, yeah, we did, brother. Well, it was good talking to you tonight. Don't be terrorized.
I feel safe. You're being protected.
You call the NSA. They're there to help.
They're always there listening, so they got your back.
They got our back in our front, too.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Take it easy. Bye-bye. Thank you.